From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Here and Now is a production of PRI and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, Public Radio's daily podcast of news and culture. Words, their meaning, and their usage are very important to us at Here and Now, so on this Friday, we thought we'd spend some time on the subject. To never split your infinitives is foolish, but we feel sometimes you just have to. And to end your sentences with prepositions is something we sometimes put up with. Linguist Jeffrey Pullum agrees. Pullum is professor of linguistics and distinguished professor of humanities at the University of California. He's also co-founder of Language Log and co-contributor to the book Far From the Matting Gerund and Other Dispatches from Language Log. We spoke recently, and I greeted him as the master of language he is. And scared of you.
Don't be scared.
Well, the fact is you're known as not being the language police.
That's right. Linguists are interested in how it does work, not interested in looking at how it works and telling people it should work some different way.
Right. You're not, you're not wagging your finger at us.
No.
No.
But
let's give people a sense of how you do listen to the world. For instance, you talk about Ray Charles's musical rendition of America the Beautiful. Now, I might listen to that and think that it's lovely. You did as well.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the nice things about writing for Language Log is you can just put in digressions and things. And I wrote about the experience of being at a concert, seeing Ray perform when he was 73 years old. And I'm so glad I did. But I realized one day, as people were playing a lot of his music on the radio after he died, that when he embellishes "God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood," as he sings America the Beautiful, he actually says something, "God done shed his grace on thee," which reveals that he's presupposing that's a past tense.
You
and
see?
I realized it's not a past tense.
No.
It's actually a subjunctive.
Well, now let's back up. A subjunctive is the mood of the verb. Have I got that
it's
right?
It's just a construction that we use for certain purposes, like exhortation and so on. In this case, "God shed his grace on thee" isn't about what God did. It means "may God shed his grace on thee."
Oh, it's a hope.
And you can tell from what Ray Charles actually says in the embellishment parts that he didn't spot that. And I thought that was an interesting linguistic point, but not from the standpoint of finger wagging. Mm. It just revealed to us that there are very subtle aspects of English grammar where all of the evidence conspires to conceal from you the way it really works. The wonder is that most people get most stuff right most of the time, because the system's really fantastically complicated.
It is, and in that case, just staying with "God shed his grace on thee," it's not about saying, "Don't you understand that's a subjunctive?" It's about opening it up to a new understanding of the line. Wow, that is beautiful. It's a prayer.
Yes.
Right? Let's hope you shed your grace.
Absolutely.
On America.
Yes. It's not a triumphalist statement that God has
shed
his grace on this great country and therefore we're great. It's actually begging God to show us some grace.
Huh. Well, I want to jump to, because there's so much, but let's jump to split infinitives. You point out that sometimes splitting the infinitive makes the sentence easier to understand. I think I did use one at the beginning when I said, "To never split your infinitives is foolish." Now, explain the split infinitive thing.
Well, the nice thing about the split infinitive is such a clear case. Everybody thinks that they can write a sort of harumphing letter to the press saying, split infinitive, and they're always right that it's always a mistake. And the truth is the extreme opposite. It's never at any time been a mistake in English. It has been grammatical for 700 years. All the finest writers use it whenever they please, and you can plunge into almost any classic book and find one, especially these days where you can search them by computer.
Well, by the way, define one. Give us one.
I wrote one once in an article that I was doing by invitation for Nature, a science magazine in London. I wrote something like, "It was surely reasonable to at least consider adopting it." And the copy editor moved my modifier, "at least," and the meaning changed. I thought, don't they understand that when you invite a grammarian to write about something about language, he might know where to put his adverbs and things? Because if you move it there, you always get a wrong result. I didn't mean it was surely reasonable at least, possibly more than reasonable. I didn't mean they should consider at least adopting it, possibly advertising it. I meant it was reasonable to at least consider adopting it. That's the only place to put at least that works. It is fully correct. It's a very, very clear case of something that isn't a rule of English and never was.
Well, and this brings us to one of the entries. Omit stupid grammar teaching is the title. It's clearly meant to diss exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, I wrote that about Strunk and White, who I must say have written together the most horrible little book. Of all the books there are, I hate it the most.
It's the elements of style.
Yes. I'm sorry you had to mention it on the air.
And but it's a Bible to many. So what is your concern with it?
If this is the Bible, don't be religious. This is a silly little book of advice that is either platitudes, like omit needless words. And of course, you can't admit them if they're required. You get crunched up over-dense writing if you literally work through your prose trying to omit every word that could have been left out. The book vacillates between platitudes like be clear and outright falsehoods like the word they must never have a singular antecedent.
I have to jump in because you just used an example of something else I wanted to bring up. You said you used the word like to give an example. You very much defend the word like you like it.
Well, at least I would say that when you look at young people saying that the lecture was like really cool and despise them for it, you should have another think about that. The upper class grown-ups that you respect use if you will and similar phrases in exactly the same way. It's a hedge. When you say it is, if you will, an epitaph, what you mean is, I'm not entirely sure that epitaph is the right word here, but it's approximately right. Bear with me. And the young people who say it was like really cool are doing the same thing with like. It's just a hedge. Everybody has them. I don't know why one of them should be despised so much, except that it's risen in frequency among the young in recent years.
In fact, you go through sentences from the Wall Street Journal and give the example with like, and I'll quote some of them. They are, if you will, this country's governing body, or they are like this country's governing body, or I think it's a reason we've done well, part of our mystique, if you will, or I think it's a reason we've done well, part of like our mystique.
That's right. It's the same function. Notice that the if you will is three syllables long, and so it's three times as long as it needs to be, so I suppose there's a few needless words to omit. But the point is that people react very strongly with a kind of allergic reaction to innovations in the speech of the young without thinking through what's actually happened here. We've got one more new use of a word as a hedge. Well, everybody has hedges. This is not a crisis.
Linguist Jeffrey Pullum, we've averted a crisis. He's co-author of the book Far From the Madding Gerund and Other Dispatches from Language Log. Language Log, by the way, is the online website devoted to all sorts of debates on words and how they're used. To link to that, go to our website, here-now.org. We were speaking about the use of the word like, how like is just a quicker, more efficient, and less formal way of saying if you will, at least according to Pullum. But I asked Pullum to explain the constant use of the word like in conversation. What does he think about that?
In their conversation, there's redundancy in everybody's speech, and different people have different redundancies. I've heard people on the radio, your very own medium, who say, it's not you though, say or every two or three words. I've been astonished that they continue to work as radio reporters, having that high a frequency of hesitation markers. But it's only a style point. That's the thing. If you overuse any feature of the language, it sounds a bit dopey. But we surely shouldn't be concluding anything about intelligence from it. So young people can just use like as much as they want. It's not going to be a measure of whether they're intelligent and whether they will one day be able to write decent essays.
We're talking to Professor Jeffrey Pullum. He's professor of linguistics and distinguished professor of humanities at the University of California. He's also author with Mark Lieberman of Far From the Madding Gerund, Other Dispatches from the Language Log. That's their website where a group of linguists write about everything. It's just a lot of fun. And just there's so much to talk about. But before we let you go, I want to talk about some of the words that you have coined to talk about the trends in speaking. One of them, snow clones. The other, egg corn. Snow clones, what's that?
Well, a snow clone is a kind of ready-made phrase for lazy journalists to plug words into to make a beginning for an article or a turn of phrase in the middle of an article. And it was named after I grumbled about an excessively overused one where you sort of begin an article something like this. But suppose we're writing an article about Robin Young, and we say, it is said that the Eskimos have 159 words for snow. Well, Robin Young must have 159 different words for interview because she's done so many of them. That's sort of nonsense. I've read this dozens of times. First, the Eskimos don't have a huge number of different words for snow. That's a myth. And second, this is a really lazy cliché. A cliché of a very specific kind where almost the whole form of the phrase or sentence is laid out for you and all you have to do is plug in your own words at certain points.
Guilty
and somebody
as charged.
Just suggested calling it a snow clone because...
Oh, guilty as charged, though, because, you know, we talk about it in the office all the time that the it's almost like the structure's there and you just put the words in. So black is the new gray. You know, that's
yes,
sort of...
That's a
shortest,
snow clone for sure.
Right, that's a... Oh, well, okay.
X is the new Y, we call it.
Right,
yes, you
right.
just plug in your own X and Y and you've got a phrase of a snappy sort that's
but you know there's
actionable.
There's so much media and you hear it so much that sometimes you have to break it in your ear. It sometimes you have to realize you're writing in that form and break it.
Yes. Keep in mind, by the way, we're not saying there's anything wrong with snow clones. It's just like this is a constantly changing, shifting thing about the language. New cliches come in. We occasionally mock a cliche, at least point out that it's a new snow clone, not really because there's anything particularly wrong with it, but to highlight a development in the language, because that's what Language Log is about. We write about things that are happening in language that have some current relevance.
Right. Egg corn, a type of slip of the ear?
Yeah, that is more like an actual new concept, because we realized what was happening with the fact that some people, when trying to write down the word acorn, which they thought they knew, would write eggcorn. And in fact, it's extremely common.
Wait, they'd write E-G-G-C-O-R-N?
Yes. Yes. Because they thought they were hearing eggcorn, and they thought that was a reasonable thing to call a little thing that's about the shape of an egg. And what's interesting about it is it's a slip of the ear, not a slip of the tongue. It's not that they don't know the word. They know it, and they know its meaning. But when they write it down, they reveal they've got a false theory about it, often quite a creative theory about it. And that's really very interesting.
Give us some examples.
A friend of mine, an academic, had always thought she was hearing people say, to all intensive purposes. But it's not to all intensive purposes. It's intents and purposes. So intents is the plural of a noun. She knew the phrase. She knew what it meant. But if she had been writing it down, she would have revealed that she had a wrong theory about how the words were put together to make the phrase.
Okay.
That's the kind of thing that happens with eggcorns. It hasn't got any particular importance. It's just a neat new mistake. Alongside malapropisms, for example, which are quite different. A malapropism is a word that you have learned with the wrong meaning. So you're actually wrong about the word.
So
if you use epitaph and think it means epigram, you really have made a mistake in your lexical learning.
Right.
It's not a mistake in the lexical learning when you think there's a word eggcorn and you know what it means. You've got the word, you've got the meaning, but you've got a wrong theory that the first part of it is egg.
One last question. Where does one of my favorites fall in? Do you have a name for this? I used to say, when I was much younger, mizzled for misled.
Oh, yes.
Is that an eggcorn?
Spelling pronunciations. No, different. But I have to admit that at one time I stared at this word myself and I was puzzled and wondered just what mizzled might mean, and luckily I learned before I ever said it. But there are plenty of people out there who say mizzled in front of somebody and have to be told at that point. They embarrass themselves. And so you are not alone.
Oh, Professor Jeffrey Pullum, the book is Far From the Madding Gerund and Other Dispatches from Language Log. And by the way, to get to Language Log, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll send you over. It is always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been fun.
Here and Now is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in weekdays at noon for live, up-to-the-minute news from around the world, and visit our website, here-now.org, for more on today's top stories. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.